1956. You know, we originally cut that song in 1949 and then recut it in 1956. Real, real burner, up-tempo, jump blues version of Chicken Shack Boogie. It's the Night Prowl Show on the 50s on 5, and it is my pleasure to bring back on the air Jimmy Rogers, who had... Jimmy, we're going to have to recap what happened 2 weeks ago, but I had you on the air 2 weeks ago to talk about this great operation that you were going to go under to get the steel plate removed from your head.
Right.
And you've had the head in... The head in. You've had your head for how many? 70-some-odd years? No. But you've had your the steel plate in your head for 40 years.
Right.
And welcome to back to the show, by the way.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I've got the steel plate here with me. You know, I've been packing it around since 1967. This thing is 29 square inches. It's, you know, it's just... I thought it was smaller than that. I measured it today. It's a little spooky, and it's heavy. You know.
Yeah, I was gonna say, how heavy is it?
It, you know, it weighs. I don't know. I'll have to weigh it. I really haven't thought about weighing it.
Do you feel the difference? Is your head lighter?
Well, you know, I've been called lightheaded before, many times. But yeah, actually, you know, this thing gets hot. Now it's 105 or 6 out here today in Palm Desert, and it's and I wear a hat, of course, whenever I go play golf or whatever that is. And also, I can feel it. I can always feel it there on the right side. It covers it. When they operated on me, they took out that much bone, and they have to overlap this plate on the edge of the bone in order for it to stay in. And they wired it in those days, and then they pull the skin up and sew it up. And what has happened to me over the last 40 years is this thing about every 3 or 4 years comes right through. I was shooting a film. I think we talked about this before with Russ Tamlin. I was directing a picture down in Kentucky. And Russ, there was a scene where he had to jump off a little bridge into the water, which is about 20 feet into the water. And he said, no, he didn't like the deal. He didn't like the look of it. So I said, well, I'd like you to just step off this edge here and jump, which I did. And when I hit the water, there was a bunch of sand underneath it that I couldn't see. And when I hit the water, the plate telescoped right up through the skin and went right up through the scalp and came out.
Mm.
And that was the start of it coming loose. And when they operated on me that time, they didn't knock me out. They give me some local anesthetic.
When was that?
This was in 1969. The 2 years after the original, when I was hurt originally. But ever since, then they started clipping on it. Ever since 1969, I've had like 2 surgeries a year, off and on, small ones and big ones, and 14 major ones where they go in and they cut pieces of steel out of my head. And this thing is cut and jagged and pointed and clipped, and no doctor would take it out. There wasn't a doctor that I could find that would even volunteer to take this thing out. One doctor, who was a neurosurgeon, came into the room where I was showing him they won't take an MRI on this, you know, you can't.
Oh, right, right.
I'd be glued to the ceiling if they did. But this doctor came in, who was a neurosurgeon with these big, thick glasses, and he laid the X-ray down on a table and put his head right up against it looking at it, and he turned at me and he said, crap. So loud. He's, oh, crap. He said, I can't touch this thing. We can't take this thing out. And not until now, not until I've been having so many problems where I can't go anywhere, and this thing was draining, and it has what they call epidural staph, that is getting really dangerous.
Oh,
and for the last month, I've been wide open, you know. And this one doctor... and I can mention his name is Dr. Jordan down in Little Rock, Arkansas. I said, Jimmy, I think we need to take this thing out. And I said, well, I've been praying about it, you know, 24 hours a day. And when he took it out, and we have a DVD of it, which I don't have now. They're editing this 2-hour surgery. When he took it out, the plate popped up like toast coming out of a toaster.
Oh, wow.
And he clipped it and lifted it right straight out and cleaned it all up, and then sewed me up, and it was only a 2-hour surgery, which I thought was going to be critical. I didn't know if I was going to come out of it.
Now,
I really didn't.
Right. Now the way you came on the air the night before the surgery, which I believe was 2 weeks ago today, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And from what I understood at the time, the deal was it was going to be a very serious surgery, because when they removed the plate, it was going to be a hole underneath it, correct?
That's right.
And they had developed this, please correct me if I'm wrong, they developed this substance that they could put over the hole to adhere to, it would like turn into bone, a bone-like substance, and it would adhere to the bone around. Is that correct?
Yeah, what they do is they it solidifies. It's evidently a liquid form of some kind, and it's like super glue, and then they can mold it right in surgery now. And this is a fairly new technique, you know. The thing is that we've caught up with each other, with me, and a lot of people who are being operated on technology, and people are catching up. Mm-hmm. They can make bone right there while you're unconscious, and they can shape it to fit whatever. But this area, this large of an area, they were, you know, I don't know if the doctors were as skeptical as I was, but I'm sure this doctor was taking a chance, but he had to make a decision when that plate came up out of there. He didn't know what was underneath there. We had no idea. Some people, they say, grow bone quickly, and some don't. And the older you get, you don't grow it as quickly. So they were totally shocked. It's like God said, "Here, I've healed this guy."
Yeah, I mean, humans don't normally do that. I mean, that, you know, it's like growing, you know, something back, that we don't have that ability normally to grow things back.
Not that much. There would be a little bit of bone growing just from what happens. But that much where it closes up an area that big, because the whole right side of my head was a piece of steel. I mean, it was just, you know, you can't even believe it. When you look at it, it looks like a hubcap.
Well, I've seen that picture of you holding the steel plate. That's up on my website, mattthecat.com, if people want to see that, of you holding the plate. Now, after surgery.
Right.
But, you know, Jimmy, you mean so much to so many people. We play your records every day. And Sarah in Pittsburgh, and Tom in New Jersey, and Tim in Arizona, and Barry in San Diego. And I could go on and on. Everyone who sends their best out to you and loves your records and requests your records every day.
Well, I hope I'll be able to start singing again, even at my age. You know, I still miss the performing and working in front of people and doing shows. And I've been off of television for many years for obvious reasons. But you know what? I look great. I'm 175 pounds, and I'm strong. And I still look fairly young, and I'm married to a wonderful lady, and I have five wonderful kids who are all grown except one. I have a 16-year-old daughter on top of everything else.
Oh, and that's, you need that like a hole in the head, Jimmy.
That's exactly right. But at least, I'm in one piece, and my book is finished. My life story book is finished, but I have to write another chapter now. We haven't released it yet, so I guess I'll have to. It's an optimistic story anyway. It's not a depressing story. It's just a story about my life and what I've done and some of the things that have happened to me over the years. And it's I'm getting really good reviews on it so far. So
that's fantastic. I really can't wait for it to be published. And when it does, you have to come back on and talk about it.
I'd like to do that. I'd like to sell some books. Maybe you can help me sell some books out there.
I'll do my best to help you sell some books. Absolutely. But you know, it's you've had such a long and great career, diverse career, and you have one of the most distinctive voices, I think, in pop music. You can really always tell it's a Jimmy Rogers record, whether you're singing something very poppy like Honeycomb, or when you're singing something a little more folky. You know, like It's Over, or Child of Clay, or, you know, Woman from Liberia. It's still you.
Well, I was lucky with that. You know, that's luck, really, because I've always been singing ever since I can remember. But when I first recorded Honeycomb, that's one of the first things they said. Well, this guy's got a voice that's different, and it's natural. It's not a I didn't work at it. I never took singing lessons or anything like that. It was a very natural voice, and still is. And when you do have that, that's something you need. If I listen to the radio and there's people that sound like somebody else and you have trouble, you know, putting them together, it doesn't help the listener. They need to know. They need to know who they are.
Exactly. But record labels like you to sound like somebody else so that they can, you know, put you in a box.
Well, they do, and some of them are more interested in selling the song than they are the artist.
Right.
I don't mean to say that in a, you know, in a derogatory way.
No, that's the way the business is. That's all.
So the artist has to. The artist has their own sound, which is like, you know, like the great Frank Sinatra had his own sound. Mm-hmm. Every time he hits one note, you know who he is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That helps a lot.
But I think you're in that class. I mean, it's a different type of singing than somebody like a Sinatra. But I think your voice is that distinct. I really do.
Well, you know, the only thing that I think about, Matt, sometimes, I wish I would have gone into more standards. You know, I did a jazz album, which I think I sent you a copy of.
Yes, you did. Oh, yes. That's very good.
Just four guys jamming without arrangements and no rehearsals. And I could sing those things, but nobody would buy me doing that then. They wouldn't have done it. It's like now Johnny Mathis, who went from doing great pop songs into jazz, not jazz, but into standard kind of type easy jazz stuff. He was very smart. He did that anyway. He understood that, and that way people can play their music on all of the standardized stations forever. Where guys like me were more or less doing record things and so on, and so therefore they don't have the amount of material that fits their playing list to play or to keep that artist on the air all the time.
But you were able to branch out and do the folk stuff that you love so much.
That's right.
Whereas, some artists wouldn't have even been able to have done that. They would have had to keep singing the teen pop songs. But you got to, you know, I mean, Waltzing Matilda, I love your version of that song, but. You know, I don't hear, if I were a record label exec, I wouldn't hear any commercial, you know, prospects in a record like that.
No, it went number one in Australia.
Yeah, of course. Australia, yeah.
Well, you know, Banjo Patterson was like our Francis Scott Key, you know. Patterson wrote Waltzing Matilda, which was a sort of a dirge. It was a marching song. And I did faster. The roulette version was really a good version, and that was used on the beach, which was the wonderful movie years ago about the atomic warfare.
Yeah.
So they used that as a title song, but it also went number one in Austria. I had Just a Closer Walk with Thee, and also Matilda and The World I Used to Know, and some Rodney Kuhn things. It all went number one over there.
Mm-hmm.
They were not even played here, hardly.
Right.
They wouldn't have been commercial here.
Right.
The business in Australia was a little bit behind us, and they were picking up on things that fit their, fit their countryside. And songs like Someplace Green, which you wouldn't know, and the people here wouldn't know, I recorded there. And Someplace Green went number one in England and went number one in Australia because of the Rod McEwen lyric about the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to, going in places, you know, Matt, we had to change our formats and sing the songs that the people wanted to hear in those areas.
But Waltzing Matilda was actually released here, though, as a single, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Do you have a few minutes? Can you hang with me for a few minutes? I want to play it right now.
Okay.
Were you going to say something else?
No, I'll listen.
This is going out to Tim in Arizona. This is fantastic. Jimmy Rogers, Waltzing Matilda, 50s on 5.
Once a jolly swag man sat beside a billabong under the shade of a